house and keeping his cigarette cupped in his hand. "She's all right," Skip said. "Fair and all." "Get your rod out," said one of the tailors again as they hopped up into the truck. The music started again. It sounded a little like what they had played on the loudspeakers on the football fields when they were graduating from the high school. Nadine was backing her car out of the driveway. She rolled down the window and leaned out toward him. "You count fish?" she said. He never got what she was saying the first time. "You count fish?" she shouted. "Yes, I did," he said. "Everyone, 100 even." "You lie," she said, and peeled out. Nadine drove like she did everything else. Skip was glad his truck was nowhere near her. Whenever he cleared roadkill from the end of the drive, flattened frogs, turtles whose shells were broken mosaics, possums with their mouths half open to show their needle teeth, he wondered whether Nadine had run them over. On Fridays, Nadine took 2 hours off to clean the Presbyterian church. She had vanity plates that Craig had gotten for her car that said, "4GSUS." Skip drove around to the front of the house to tell Mrs. Blessing about the apple trees, about how shoots were already beginning to grow from the freshly pruned limbs, and even a leaf or two to emerge, soft and uncreased as one of her linen handkerchiefs. Faith stirred in the porta-crib, threw one arm over her head, and smacked her lips lazily. Skip was putting her on her back now. He wished the doctors would make up their minds about what position was least likely to cause crib death. He wondered if it was normal for parents to be as obsessed with their kid as he was. He'd be riding down the street, and he'd see one of those little pink bikes with silver streamers on the handlebars, and he'd file it away for later. Pink bike, Christmas 4 years from now. Or he'd see some little girl in a lace top with her belly hanging out and pierced ears, and he'd think, no way. Maybe people with birth certificates in the dresser drawer could be more casual about those things. Through the window, he could see Jennifer Foster sitting at the piano playing, her face bent over the keys. Her hands rose and fell like pale birds balancing on a limb in the half-darkness that was always inside the house because of the trees and the deep-striped awnings. He could see what would come next in the music, how the tempo or the mood would change by the slight signals of her arms and head just a moment before. He stood for several minutes listening and watching, and then when she stopped playing, he knocked softly on the screen door. "Yes," Mrs. Blessing called. "It's me." "Come in, Charles," she replied. "I can't get used to the Charles thing," Jennifer said, smiling. "Nicknames are pernicious," Mrs. Blessing said. "I was always grateful that your parents did not call you Jenny or Jen or one of those diminutive versions of Jennifer, which is a lovely name." "I never really heard you play the piano," Skip said. "I'm out of practice. The only place I play is here. It drives my mother crazy after all those years of piano lessons. Piano lessons, dance lessons, tap, jazz, you name it, I took it." "My daughter, Meredith, took piano," Mrs. Blessing said. "She hated her lessons. Luckily, one summer when she was with her grandparents in Newport, she fell from a horse and broke 2 fingers, and that was that. She was always injuring herself, riding so much. She was like my brother in that regard. Both of them were accident-prone." She looked at Jennifer. "Perhaps that's hereditary, although I've never injured myself at all." Skip wasn't sure why, but she looked different this morning. Older, grayer, and yet less tense at the same time. Her hands lay open in her lap instead of tightly folded, and her mouth was looser, too. He wondered if it was the music. When he told her about the trees, he thought for just a moment that she was going to smile. He had thought from the beginning that there was something almost virginal about her, as though nothing had ever happened to her, as though her entire life had been listening to piano music in the living room and making sure the nasturtiums around the walk didn't have blight. All the women he'd known growing up, the ones with a suggestion of soft, swaying skin beneath their dresses, or the ones like his aunt who were hard and wiry and lined, all of them had faces and bodies that spoke of hard work, childbirth, aging, heartaches. Maybe it was the way Mrs. Blessing's clothes were pressed, or her hair always pulled back in the same bun, that made her seem so different from those others. Today she seemed oddly youthful.
"I'm glad you're both in one place, and that Nadine has business elsewhere," she finally said.
"Charles, I think you should tell Jennifer about what's been going on here."
"What?"
"I hate that word. The phrase is, pardon me."
"You know exactly what I mean. I think we should be prepared for any eventuality, including illness, for example, or discovery. By being in my employ, you've made this my business, too, and I think you need some assistance in making certain that there won't be trouble in the years to come."
Jennifer was looking at Mrs. Blessing with a line between her eyebrows. It was the same line that Nadine had between hers, permanently, a kind of tattoo of ill humor.
"Jennifer is entirely trustworthy," Mrs. Blessing added. "I can tell you that from long experience. What will you do if the child is sick? What about school immunization records? She may know more than either of us does about how to proceed here."
"What child?" Jennifer said.
"He has a child," said Mrs. Blessing, the soft line of her mouth gone now, its narrow band of probity back in place.
"Hey, hey," cried Skip. "Wait a minute."
"Oh, God," said Jennifer Foster, looking away with disgust. "Not you two. I'm so tired of this. Doesn't anyone take having kids seriously anymore? I remember at home how angry all the women were about the American soldiers who had gotten them pregnant and then just left, but here it's exactly the same. Fathers who think it's a big deal to let someone use their last name on a birth certificate." The line between her brows deepened.
"Oh, I know who it is. You knocked up that girl who used to work at the Red Lobster out on the pike. She was in my gym class freshman year. You can't even let her live here with you so you can see your own kid?"
Skip could feel the color rise in his face as the shame and anger bloomed in his chest. He walked out the screen door and went over to the truck bed. Faith was awake, staring at the leaves on the copper beach overhead with a sleepy smile. Her eyebrows were still light as dandelion fuzz, and her eyes had faded from navy to a lighter blue, more like the sky. Something about her peach-pink face and the smile and the way she was such a good baby and scarcely cried and didn't get cradle cap or whiteheads or diaper rash or all the other disgusting things he imagined Shelley's baby got, made the shame disappear and the anger rise in him along with the pride and love. He lifted her from the porta crib and carried her into the house so that she was facing out, one hand around her chest, the other beneath her butt, with the kind of casual roughness he associated with a job a person knows how to do well.
"This is Faith," he said. "She's not mine, or she's kind of mine. Whatever, I'm her father. I found her by the garage in June, and I've been taking care of her ever since. You might be trustworthy, but you're too quick to judge people as far as I'm concerned."
"Oh, my God!"
Jennifer said and reached out her hands like it was a cold night and Faith was afire.
"Oh, my God, you are so adorable. Look at you. Look at her. She's smiling right at me. Look at her eyes. Oh, how blue her eyes are. Come over here. Come and see me, sweetheart."
The baby made a noise, half purr, half growl, as Jennifer pushed forward on the piano bench and laid her down the length of her legs. Faith held on to Jennifer's fingers with her fists.
"So, you see the difficulty," said Mrs. Blessing. "She needs her immunizations, and soon, as I recall. I'm confident that I can persuade Dr. Benjamin that she's some relation and that he will do it."
"Dr. Benjamin doesn't practice anymore." Jennifer looked down and pitched her voice higher.
"No, he doesn't, does he, sweetie? He doesn't take care of babies anymore."
"He will do it for me, but what about the mother? What if some young girl suddenly decides that she's made a mistake? Although what counts as a mistake nowadays is beyond me. It seems there's nothing that counts against you young people. No one seems to care about the old rules."
"They just pretend they don't care about them," Skip said, reaching for Faith.
"Oh, let me hold her some more,"
Jennifer said.
"Who is your mommy, sweetie?"
She tilted her head to the side and the baby grabbed her hair and pulled until Jennifer's chin was bent low. It occurred to Skip that babies had a way of making people exactly what they were, but more so.
Faith had brought out the rectitude and responsibility in Mrs. Blessing, the warmth in Jennifer Foster, and the capability in him, so that she had made him think well of himself. And having a baby made all those people who were piss-poor humans more piss-poor than ever. "I can ask at the ER," Jennifer said, "but I think I would have heard if anyone had come in postpartum with no child. There's a girl on one of those big farms by the county line who's only 14 and got pregnant, but she had her baby about 3 weeks ago, and from what I heard, her mother and grandmother went from calling her a whore to acting like she's the greatest thing since sliced bread as soon as she delivered. There's been a couple of girls I heard about who had babies without being married in the last couple months, but that's no big deal these days. I guess I shouldn't talk. My parents didn't get married until I was 5 when we came over here, but that was a different situation." Her head bent lower. "I need my hair back, sweetie," she sang to the baby. "She has a really tight grip, right?" Skip said. "Strong." "Does my mother know about this?" Jennifer asked. Skip snorted. "Right," he said. "Nobody was supposed to know, not even you. But someone found out, and now that someone has taken it upon herself to tell other people." "I have no intention of telling anyone except Jennifer," Mrs. Blessing said. "I suspect we may need her help." "Well, don't tell my mother," said Jennifer. "She's strange about things, especially things like this. You can't be sure what she'll do. Actually, I know what she'd say. She'd say it's really yours, and you just made this whole story up." "I've still got the box they left her in," said Skip, "and the flannel shirt she was wrapped in." "So you know of no one who might claim this child?" Mrs. Blessing said, putting her hand on Jennifer's arm. "I don't know of anyone who's missing a baby, to tell the truth. I'll nose around a bit, though." Jennifer looked up at Skip. "I'm sorry I made you sound like a slime ball. Here's all these guys walking away from their own kids, and you're taking care of a baby that's not even yours." "She's mine." "Yeah, I get that. Can I play with her a little while longer?"
"She's a very good baby," Mrs. Blessing said. "I must admit it. She's no trouble at all."
Meredith was sawing away at her lamb chop. "Nadine told me that you had a lightning strike," she said, "and a blackout. That must have been sort of scary." "Lightning is more dangerous than most people think," Meredith's husband Eric said. Lydia scarcely listened to them. She watched Meredith's knife go back and forth like a violinist's bow. "Nadine," she called, "this meat is tough." "Sometimes. Often. Nearly all the time now." She felt as if she'd outlived her own life. Madame Guanair's no longer made the cotton blouses she liked so much. The Times no longer ran engagement announcements, and they put divorces in the wedding announcements, as though anyone would want to be reminded on their wedding day that their previous marriage had ended in divorce. And 4 years ago, she had gotten a card from the butcher on Third Avenue, who had been sending her meat for 50 years, announcing that he was retiring and closing his business. Even the butcher in Mount Mason, who had been hugely and publicly bitter about the meat sent to Blessings from New York. "No difference from what I stock, except that she's paying a premium, I can tell you that," was out of business now. Nadine had to buy meat at the Mount Mason supermarket. The chicken tasted like sponge, and not even like real sponge, the yellow, misshapen kind that had once actually lain at the bottom of the ocean and that still could be sent to her, thank God, from the pharmacy on the corner of 72nd Street and Lexington Avenue. The supermarket chicken tasted like that horrid manufactured sponge that Nadine used on the dishes. "You can't get good asparagus this late in the summer," she said, picking up a spear with her fingers and then setting it down in disgust. "Mother, you can get everything all the time now. You can get corn year-round, and tomatoes. Everything is shipped overnight from California or Florida." "I don't call those things you can get in the supermarket tomatoes. I'm surprised you can with the tomatoes we've always gotten here in the summer. Charles is taking good care of the vegetable garden. These are our own tomatoes and our own summer squash. I can't imagine why Nadine thought we ought to have asparagus in September." Sometimes she thought that the world had lost its compass. Peaches were meant to be eaten in the summer, apples in the fall. Her mother had once seen a girl in dark shoes at a lawn party in June in Connecticut and turned away before she could be introduced. Miss Bertram had sent a senior home because she was wearing nail polish. It was clear nail polish, but nail polish nonetheless. Nail varnish, they called it then. And sometimes, now she wondered, improbably, whether the compass had been set askew to begin with. She looked at Faith sometimes, lying on the lawn in the growing dusk, with a tent of mosquito netting around her and her Humpty Dumpty rattle in her hand, and wondered what all the old mores really meant. Lydia Blessing, who had been taught that illegitimacy was a curse and eavesdropping insidious, sometimes lay in bed with the baby monitor turned on her bedside table and listened as though to chamber music to the faint sounds of the young man and the infant living happily together. Sometimes she forgot to turn it off as she fell asleep, and when the baby woke at 3, she woke too, and heard the few irritated complaints and then the sound of Charles coming into the room. "Hungry again? Huh?" he might croon. "All right, all right, it's coming. Hold your little horses, you little honey, you little honey, you." It was the language of love, and it had shifted her made-up mind on its lifelong axis. What did it matter how you got to that moment, so long as you got there in time? "You're looking well, Meredith," she said now, turning to her daughter, and she was faintly pained by the look of surprise on Meredith's face. What did it matter what had led up to that moment? Meredith suddenly looked pleased. "Thank you, Mother," she said, lifting a hand to her hair. "You too." "Oh, nonsense," Lydia said. "You haven't had surgery, have you?" Meredith's smile fell a little. "No, Mother, no surgery." "Good. I think all that is nonsense. Grow old and learn to like it, or live with it, at the very least." The three of them bent over their meals in silence. The lights in the dining room flickered. "I'm glad you decided to have work done on the orchard," Meredith said. "I always loved it there when I was a child." "Who says I'm doing work on the orchard?" "Nadine did." "Nadine should mind her business." Lydia didn't like it when Meredith behaved as though the place were already hers. Lydia's father had hated that too, had hated it when her mother had deeded Blessings over to Lydia 5 years after Meredith was born. It was after Lydia had had Mr. Foster, the second Mr. Foster, drive her to the city in the big Buick for Lucy Warren's wedding. It was the first big wedding after the war. "Oh, Lydia," Lucy had said when she'd seen her outside the church, "I never thought you'd come." "But I sent you a card and said I would," she'd said. "Well, my mother said you never would," Lucy had said, pushing aside her veil. Perhaps she'd imagined it, but Lydia thought that many of her old friends looked surprised when they saw her at the reception afterward. And one girl she'd scarcely known took her hands and told her how terribly, terribly sorry she'd been about Benny, and what a wonderful, wonderful man he'd been, and how was the baby? Was she well? "She's scarcely a baby anymore," Lydia had said. "She's almost 5. She'd stopped afterward at her parents' house, but both of them were out, and she could not stay over because of Mr. Foster waiting in the car, his head swiveling as though New York were surrounding him on all sides and surreptitiously creeping forward to seize and eat him. Driving across the park, she'd realized that the city was like the pond at Blessings, that her life here had been a small splash, a series of concentric circles, and now the water was smooth again. She'd taken her gold compact out of her purse, the compact with her monogram that Mrs. Carton had given her for a wedding gift, and she'd looked at her own face in the mirror within the lid, touched her brow, her upper lip, to see that she was really there. She'd been so tired when she got back to Blessings that day. Her garters had bitten into the flesh of her upper thighs and left red marks, and Meredith had come in while she was changing and tried to touch them, and she'd had to tell her that people needed their privacy when they were dressing and undressing. Now people changed clothes on the beach in front of strangers and thought nothing of it. People hired men to take care of their property, and somehow, out of the blue, infants turned up in their living quarters, needing to be held and fed and somehow cared for by these men, who were supposed to be pruning the trees and keeping the creeping chrysanthemum from creeping. But Faith was surprisingly easy to feed. Mrs. Blessing had done it twice now, once when Charles was out, once when he'd handed her the baby in the bottle. She had to hold her in her right arm now because her left ached so much of the time, and she worried that if the feeding went on too long, the weight would be too much for her. But so far, it had not. The baby sucked on the nipple with an avidity and a need that was somehow touching. Mrs. Blessing could not remember what it had been like to feed Meredith. The baby nurse had said she was inexperienced. The woman had rolled her R's so that inexperience sounded much more serious than it might have otherwise. She was German. Ethel Blessing always got the servants no one else wanted, the black cooks, the Irish girls with spaces between their front teeth, the German baby nurses during the war. It had occurred to Mrs. Blessing as she held the bottle while the child sucked noisily that perhaps she had never actually given Meredith a bottle. She had been so young when Meredith was born. She'd been only 19 years old when she'd gone to that drinks party she had dreamed of as an old woman in the hospital. Frank Askew had raised his glass from the other side of the room. He had given her that hard look that made her groin swim and her face turn red. She thought no one noticed. How stupid she'd been. How surprised everyone had been to see her only 5 years later at Lucy Warren's wedding, as though it had been arranged for the earth to swallow her up. Of course, her mother had wanted her to stay hidden away at Blessings. 6 months after that first time, Frank had reached into the neck of her yellow voile dress and pulled her breast loose to kiss its upper curve, and she had felt her knees bend and open. His mustache scratched her skin slightly, and then he drew back and stared down at the dark nipple, the swell of the skin, and his pelvis stopped pushing against hers as though he'd been struck by lightning. "You need to go get looked at," he'd said, pulling the top of her dress up far higher than it was meant to be. "Get looked at? By a doctor." She was so stupid then that she had needed a man to look at the swell of her breasts and feel the slight curve of her belly and tell her she was pregnant. 11 weeks, said the doctor in Westchester, whom Frank sent her to see the next day. That night, she went to Chez Nous, one of those clubs that had sprung up where girls who'd gone to college and come home again, and men who were waiting to be shipped overseas went to have a good time before they got married, or had children, or surrendered to being grown up. She'd had too much to drink, then insisted that everyone at her table go on the subway to a place she'd heard about downtown for breakfast. She was fast-talking and frantic that night, not like herself, and the New York she encountered was not her New York. It was an underground city in which strangers sat opposite one another on the train, eyes blank, shoulders touching anonymously. The New York she knew was the opposite of anonymous, in which all of them went to the same few schools and knew one another's parents, and the servants knew everyone else's servants, and everyone used the same apothecary, and everyone's children wore the same broadcloth coat with a velvet collar and matching leggings from the child's shop. It was, she was discovering, a small town in which things were secret, not because they were not known, but because they were not spoken aloud. The place she'd heard about turned out to be nothing more than an all-night luncheonette, but almost everyone there was someone they knew, except for one disgusted cab driver at the counter eating sausages and making comments to the waitress about trust fund babies and rich kids and uptown brats. Lydia threw up in the ladies' room, which smelled like disinfectant, and had a sign that said, "Don't waste paper, there's a war on." When she came out, Benny was at a table by himself near the window, wearing his new uniform. The sleeves were too long, the pants too short. "Keep me company," he'd said. "Your brother stood me up." He was drunk, too, and when he ordered fried eggs, she thought she'd be sick again. She had toast with butter and tea that she drank in little sips. Neither of them said much until Benny reached over and took her hand. "What's the matter, Liddy?" he said, and she started to cry. The only words that would come out were, "I need, I need, I need, I need," between wet sobs and heaves, and then another trip to the ladies. "What do you need, Liddy?" he said when she'd come back. "I need help," she said softly. "What kind of help?" "I need someone to marry me." There was a silence. Benny buttered his toast. The cab driver said, "You can't respect a person who doesn't work for a living." The waitress said, "Don't be so hard on people." Benny said, "I'd marry you. I'd be happy to marry you." Now Meredith said, "The landscaping is looking lovely, Mother." Lydia's head came up slowly, like one of the water birds fishing around the pond that tried to pretend that they weren't there, that they were really a rock or a stick or a part of the dock. She hadn't been following the conversation. Her head hurt. "I need aspirin," she said. "I'll get some," Meredith said. "Nadine, can you bring 2 aspirin and some fresh water? Are you all right, Mother?"
"Don't fuss, Meredith. It's only a headache."
"You have the healthiest pink dogwoods I've ever seen, Lydia," said Eric, whom she'd never grown to like, although to his credit, he was always respectful and never slobbered much, unlike Jess's oldest son-in-law, the one who'd called Jess Mama. Not Ed, who was married to Jean, but Brian, who'd been married to Marion, the one who died of cancer of the pancreas. That was how she remembered people now. Heart, stroke, cancer of the pancreas. She swallowed the aspirin slowly. Meredith looked so much like her father that anyone who saw the two of them together would have been amazed by the resemblance. No one had ever seen the two of them together. When Meredith traveled to town as a child, it was to go to the Radio City Music Hall Christmas show or the plaza for tea with her grandparents, and then to come back to Mount Mason again. After Lucy Warren's wedding, Mrs. Blessing had gone back herself only 3 other times. During her pregnancy, and then when the baby was small, she had sustained herself with the knowledge that before long the war would be over, and she would leave Mount Mason and go back to the city. Not leave for good, of course. Blessings would always be her second home for weekends and holidays. But the city was where she belonged. When Benny's mother had first mentioned that long-ago aunt with the red hair, and Mr. Carton had written the will that left Meredith everything, it had given her hope that everyone would be as publicly credulous as Benny's parents were. Even the people who had been in the hallways when she and Frank Askew had emerged, never together, always one at a time, from certain unused rooms at certain apartments and clubs. She had not counted on her mother. The week after Lucy Warren's wedding, her parents had come for the weekend. While her father danced Meredith around the living room singing "Let Me Call You Sweetheart," her mother had taken her out onto the porch and handed her the deed to the property. Ethel Simpson Blessing to Lydia Blessing Carton. That was how the transference read. Her father had built the barn, added the porch, planted the trees around the pond, put up the fences, landscaped the terrace gardens, laid out the orchard. All of it had been owned by his wife. "Ah, Lids, my love," he sighed over dinner, his hands shaking as he lifted his coffee cup, the whites of his eyes gone yellow. "I miss this place terribly." The past danced again with the present in her mind. Meredith was talking, using the flat of her hand to smooth back her hair. Lydia had named her after Benny's grandmother. The Cartons had liked that. They'd sent a monogrammed locket from Tiffany. Her mother had handed her the deed and said, "Now you'll always have a place to live." 2 months later, her parents moved into a small apartment at a residential hotel on Fifth Avenue. Then there was no place for Lydia in New York, and no money for her to buy a place of her own. Her mother gave her an allowance to run Blessings, and her parents stayed at the house 1 weekend a month, and during the month in the summer when Meredith was in Newport. "I'd rather be here with the little girl," her father complained, but that was how Ethel Blessing arranged things. Her father had seemed to get smaller and grayer, and afterward, Lydia thought that maybe he'd been sick for years before he died. Or maybe he was just exhausted from the unacknowledged drama of his life. Sonny had betrayed him. He had gone into advertising and made a huge success of a slogan for a pen that read, "He's got the prettiest penmanship at Princeton, and he uses a papermate." When Sonny spoke of their father, when he came out to Blessings alone for the weekend, circling the pond with his head lowered and his cigarette trailing a plume of gray smoke, it was with amused contempt. On the patio one evening, he had said, Have you ever noticed that Father has never said anything of moment in his entire life? You're so hard on him, Sonny, she had said.
Ah, Lids, my love,
Sonny had replied, imitating their father. If only I were. Their mother had given Sonny an allowance, too. Perhaps Lydia had thought she even put their father on an allowance. Maybe that accounted for the boxes. From time to time, her father had sent Lydia a box at Blessings by mail, so that the postman had to send a boy to drive it out. Simpson's Fine Textiles, it said on each of the boxes, and when she had opened the first one, there was a bolt of heavy green brocade the color of new leaves, and a note from her father on his personal stationery. Put this away for a rainy day, it said. Love and kisses, Papa. The boxes came two or three times a year, always with the same message, always with a bolt of fabric. Beneath the fabric was money. Lots of money. In big packages encircled with paper bands, like the money in kidnap scenes in movies. She estimated that the first box contained $4,000. And then there was a second and a third, and by the time her father died, there were stacks of boxes in the garage attic, most of them unopened. It seemed dirty, that money. The green faded to gray, the paper soft from the hands that had touched it. To have money in her world had been to go to the right schools, live in a proper apartment, furnish it in the old style. It was not to have boxes of bills like some old miser with a mattress full. They never spoke of it, she and her father, or her mother either, or even Sonny. Sometimes she almost forgot it was there. Sometimes she wondered whether the mice had gotten to it. By the time Meredith was starting school, there was enough money over the garage to buy herself a place in the city. But for some reason, she had had the guest rooms painted instead, and had stayed put. "Do you want tea with your rice pudding?" Meredith asked.
"We'll have tea on the porch," Lydia said.
"Whatever you say, Mother."
"Those are beautiful delphiniums," Eric said heartily, pulling out her chair as she rose slowly.
"Staking," she said. "If you want delphiniums, you must keep them staked." There were still some things of which she was absolutely certain. Skip heard Jennifer Foster arrive before the roofers or Nadine did, while Mrs. Blessing's daughter and son-in-law were at the club playing golf. The idle on her car had been fixed. Skip could hear it as she pulled up and into one of the bays at the garage. When he put Faith in her arms, the baby pushed back and stared her in the face. The book said Faith wouldn't have stranger anxiety until she was 10 months old. Maybe by then she wouldn't consider Jennifer or Mrs. Blessing strangers.
"Good morning, pretty girl,"
Jennifer said in that high voice people always use for babies. "How are you? Did you sleep good last night?"
"She did," Skip said. "If I put her down at midnight now, she goes straight through until 6. I weighed her on the feed scale in the back of the garage, and she's up to 14 pounds, which I think is pretty big."
"Are you pretty big? Are you? You don't look so big to me."
Jennifer looked up at him and smiled. "Mr. Mom," she said.
"That's me."
"You have my stuff?" He closed the garage door over her little car and turned to watch her lope across the lawn with the sling across her chest and a backpack filled with bottles and diapers on her back. Jennifer had come the day before to say hello to Mrs. Blessing's daughter, whose name was Mrs. Fox.
"Charles,"
Mrs. Blessing had called as Jennifer was leaving, and she came down the back step slowly and carefully to join the two of them.
"I told Jennifer there's too much activity here in the next day or two," she said quietly. "It might be useful for Faith to stay with her away from here."
"I can hear the rumors now," Skip said. "I won't leave the property," Jennifer said. "I know how you feel about that. I can take her way back by the stream where nobody comes. Otherwise, between Mr. and Mrs. Fox and the roofing crew, somebody's going to figure out she's here. Speaking of rumors, there aren't any. There was a girl at the hospital about 6 months ago who had a baby and gave it up for adoption, but these people came from Chicago and picked it up. Tracy at the pharmacy on Main Street says the girl's even gotten pictures from them since. One of the Boatwright girls had twins in June, but they were both boys, and she has them both at home in the trailer and complains to anyone who listened about how hard it is to have two. And some couple who live in the Foxwoods development had a baby girl near the end of June, but she was born with some terrible birth defects and died the next day. Oh, man, Skip said. So faith fell from the sky, I guess, right down to Mr. Mom. Mr. Mom. That was what she called him now. He didn't kid himself that it meant more than a nice person being nice. Watching her disappear behind the line of tall cedars, her strides springy and sure, Skip thought that Faith would have a nice long day and he would merely have a long one, ripping shingles from an old roof on a clear blue morning with a full sun beating down. There was one honest roofer in Mount Mason, the rest being beer-drinking thieves who took a couple of $1,000 and slapped shingles haphazardly along the roof line. Luckily, the one honest roofer was Ed's father, Jim. Mr. Salzano, Skip had called him when he hired him, which maybe wasn't the best way to begin a professional relationship in which he was supposed to be the boss. But he needed the barn re-roofed badly now. The lightning had hit the rod, that was for sure. But it had ricocheted onto the asphalt shingles and the wood beneath and feasted, delighted on the dry wood and gummy roof cement for at least a few minutes before the rain had doused it. The rain that had poured in over the weeks since then was beginning to rot the timbers in the floor of the hayloft. There's not a whole lot of point in doing this unless we rip it down to the roofline and start over again, Jim Salzano had said when he came out to look at it the first time. There's a lot of rot along the gutters. Nobody's done anything to this roof for maybe 30 years. Go ahead, Skip said. Big job. I'll get up there with you. Might as well. That'll help then. Mrs. Blessing's daughter came down to watch them work while she was visiting. She was a tall woman, too, in a big hat that kept the sun off her face. He'd heard Mrs. Blessing calling from the house, demanding that she come back inside and get something on her head so she would not freckle. By the time she and her husband came back from playing golf and having lunch, old shingles were scattered in heaps around the grass, and a pile of them were on a big flatbed to be taken away. The two lightning rods lay on their sides. She nudged one with the toe of her shoe, then put out her hand to Skip. He could feel the calluses as he shook it. It's criminal, the way this building has been allowed to degenerate, she said. It's not used for anything. I know. If I had it down at our farm, I'd use it. It's a wonderful barn, actually, built the way buildings aren't built anymore. I sound like my mother. Nothing is the same as it was. Do you like working for her? She pays a decent wage. I very much doubt that. Maybe a decent wage by the standards of 1955. How does she seem to you? I couldn't really say. I haven't known her that long. Did you ask Nadine? Mrs. Blessing's daughter laughed again. Meredith Fox, her name was. That's what Jennifer had told him. Nadine tells me a good deal, but only when I don't ask a direct question. When I asked how Mother was, I believe Nadine said, ha! She looked up at the barn. 4x4s instead of 2x4s. You don't see that anymore, Mr. Salzano said from atop a ladder. She nodded. We kept horses here all through my childhood. You should have seen my mother ride. What a seat she had. You should have seen her swim, for that matter. She'd go off the dock and do the breaststroke from one end to the other and then back again. She'd swim like a fish for half an hour. Golf, too. And tennis, doubles mostly. She stopped almost 20 years ago. Her best friend died and she was never the same. She seems okay to me, said Skip, thinking about the way Mrs. Blessing barked Nadine's name when she wanted her, the way she kept watch with her binoculars, as though she were on the lookout for some enemy incursion down the driveway, the way she held the baby now and ran her long fingers over Faith's face. He wished he could tell all this to Mrs. Fox, who seemed so nice, how her mother sat on the porch at night and sometimes commanded him to lift Faith into her arms so that she could rock back and forth in one of the old porch rockers until Faith's lids dropped. Her mouth fell open, and she breathed the slow, sibilant baby breath of sleep. She needs to get out more. Travel, Mrs. Fox said. She could afford it. She lives in the past too much. It's not healthy. I guess it depends on how good the past was, Skip said, thinking of his bedroom with the bucking bronco on the quilt. She tilted her head a bit, and Skip flushed because it occurred to him that for an older lady, she was really good-looking. Her eyes were the same color as the pond, and they tilted at the corner even more than Jennifer Foster's. "May I ask you a personal question?" she said. "Shoot. Were you really in prison for armed robbery?" "No, ma'am. I pled to a burglary charge and got less than a year in county. County jail, I mean." "Anything else?" "No, ma'am. I just happened one time to be in the wrong place at the wrong time."
"I can second that," Mr. Salzano called down from the top of the ladder. "Absolutely. With the wrong bunch of guys, too." He looked at Skip. "I may be dumb, Skipper, but I'm not stupid."
"Your reputation is far worse than the reality, then," Meredith Fox said seriously.
"That's sort of the way, isn't it?"
Skip replied. Mrs. Blessing's daughter took the back path to the pond then, a groundhog and its plump kits scattering in her wake. When he went to the garage to get a crowbar, he saw her out in the little boat, rowing hard from one end of the pond to another. He figured the horses must keep her in better shape than most women her age, and he was glad he'd washed down the boat with a hose so she hadn't found it dusty, full of tattered webs and dead flies. He stopped for a moment to look at her, at the rise of the mountain around the valley, at the slope of the valley around the pond and the house, at the small wooden boat at its center. It was probably tough to buy a wooden boat these days. Fiberglass, aluminum, that's what they made now. He liked the wood. "Man," he said under his breath, thinking there couldn't be greater happiness than to own a place like this. Mrs. Fox pulled the boat onto the bare patch of lawn by the dock and went to the garage for one of the old fly-casting rods. Her arm moved back and forth, as though she were drawing in the air with the line. A hairy yellow lure flew up and across, then set down solidly on the surface of the water. Skip thought he saw the dark shadow of a trout move toward it below the water. She looked toward him and smiled.
"I could dig you some night crawlers, if you'd rather have an easier time of it," Skip called, walking toward her.
She shook her head. "I like fly casting. I don't particularly like catching fish. And Nadine won't clean them. Apparently she put her foot down about two things, a uniform and cleaning fish. The uniform was almost the end of it as far as my mother was concerned."
"I'll clean fish for you if you want."
"If I catch anything, I'll take you up on the offer, but I don't think I'm likely to." Skip squinted toward the surface of the pond. At the far end, a pair of green herons were hunched over the water, heads low between their folded wings, waiting for slow sunfish to edge into the warm water close to shore. One heron jabbed suddenly, hoisted a wriggling twist of silver aloft, let it slide down his frantically working craw, settled back into position. Mrs. Blessing's daughter cast out again.
"That lure is actually for big fish, shad maybe, or pike."
She laughed again. Skip wondered where she'd learned to laugh so easily. So far, he'd never heard Mrs. Blessing's laugh.
"Well, I said I wouldn't catch anything."
"Meredith," called a man's voice from the house, "do you want to have a drink at the club before dinner?"
"Not much,"
she called back as a small trout broke the water and leaped into the air a foot from her moving lure.
"I'm very contented at the moment."
Skip liked the sound of that.
"I'd better get to work," he said.
"I want to power wash the inside of the barn before we go any further. But I can stop to clean fish. Or get you bait, if you want." "When I was a little girl, I used to watch those fish jump out of the water, and I used to think they were jumping for joy," Meredith said. "And then one day when I was older, I was walking around the pond, and I noticed how they swam back and forth, back and forth. I suppose I finally noticed how small the pond was. And one of them jumped, and all I could think was that he was trying to escape, except that he would die outside."
"You've got a fish on there," Skip said, watching her lure disappear.
By the next evening, she and her husband were gone. The Chevy Suburban with the horse trailer pull disappearing down the long drive, while the lens of the binoculars flashed in the fading light from the upstairs sleeping porch. The old barn roof was ripped off, the new shingles packed in blocks around it ready for the next day. Jennifer had put in 2 days with Faith, and come back to the house, slightly grubby, only minutes after the fox's car, the roofer's truck, and Nadine's little compact had all pulled away. Rain was beginning to fall, making a pale gray haze over the pond.
"I'm in love," Jennifer said, lifting Faith's slack little body from the sling on the back steps.
"Come inside," Mrs. Blessing called. "You too, Charles."
The kitchen was at the east end of the house. An afternoon, Skip had noticed that it was in a kind of perpetual twilight. Although when he made the coffee in the morning, the old white stove and yellow cabinets were warmed by the morning light. He looked around at the clean, clear countertops, the shining stainless steel sink. A platter covered with a striped cloth was the only dish in sight. Nadine was the cleanest person he'd ever known. She confirmed a suspicion he'd always had that there was some kind of link between cleanliness and meanness. He bet Jennifer Foster wasn't half as clean as her mother. Little pieces of hair were pulled loose from her ponytail now, and she had a big dirt stain on the seat of her pants.
"I wondered if you would care to join me for something to eat," Mrs. Blessing said.
"I don't want to put you to any trouble," Jennifer said.
"I probably need to give the baby a bath," Skip said, rubbing the curve of her back, warm and solid under his hand.
"I put her in the stream," Jennifer said.
"The stream? It's freezing!"
"Just her feet. She liked it. She sort of sucked in her breath, then she paddled."
"Oh, man, you should have asked me about that first."
"Excuse me," said Mrs. Blessing, leaning on the counter by the platter and folding up the cloth over it.
"I thought perhaps we could picnic by the pond. There are ham sandwiches and some coleslaw. I had Nadine leave a quilt and a basket on the hall table. I suspect she thinks I'm entering my dotage."
Skip could hear the rain on the roof, a soft staccato, but insistent.
"It's raining," Jennifer said.
"Ah," said Mrs. Blessing, cocking her head, "I didn't notice."
"What about the side porch?" Jennifer said.
Skip wondered what the hell Mount Mason would say if it could peek in the wall of windows and see them laying the quilt on the polished wood floor, putting Faith down in one corner on a small pink blanket Mrs. Blessing had had ready, sitting with a plate of sandwiches and a pitcher of lemonade and a stack of gold-edged flowered plates so thin and fine that when one touched the other oh so lightly, it chimed like a doorbell. Mrs. Blessing stayed in an old white wicker chair, but he and Jennifer sat practically knee to knee on the quilt. Faith was sleeping on her stomach, smacking her lips from time to time.
"I've got a spare bottle left in that bag," Jennifer said with her mouth full. "She just sucked down the other three.
Don't you think maybe she's ready for some real food?"
"See, that's another thing that I'm not sure about. Some of the books say 4 months, some say 6. They're not real specific about solid food. There's a lot of stuff about breastfeeding."
"I tried, but it didn't work," said Jennifer, laughing.
"Uh-oh, I shocked Mrs. Blessing. Look at her."
"I'm not sure I'm capable of being shocked at my age," Mrs. Blessing said.
"You were shocked when you first saw Faith," Skip said.
"Yes, I was. That's absolutely true. I was shocked."
"And delighted," said Jennifer.
"That's the word. I picked that up from television or something when I was a little kid, and I used to use it all the time. Can you imagine what it was like in first grade when I said something was delightful?"
"There was another word, too, I think."
"Zesty, that was it. That one I got from commercials. This sandwich is very zesty," I used to say. My mother learned to speak English from American soldiers. Her big thing when we first got here was figuring out which words she'd learned that weren't words you were supposed to say in polite company. And getting rid of y'all. I guess a lot of the guys she knew were Southern. I used to say y'all, too. I remember one of my father's cousins getting a big laugh when he said, "We must be from South Korea."
"It must have been really bad, coming here like that," Skip said.
"Mount Mason, especially. I mean, the city would have been different."
"The prejudices in cities are the same as in small towns, Charles," Mrs. Blessing said. "They are simply hidden a little better."
"It was strange coming here," Jennifer said. "All those years I dreamed about coming to America and seeing my father and how it was going to be perfect. And then in one day, I was here."
"And it was completely different than you'd expected."
Jennifer shook her head.
"No, it was fantastic. I got off the plane, and there was this big man, bigger than anyone I'd ever seen in my life, and he lifted me up, and he held me, and I could feel him crying on my face and my hair. I'd never seen a man cry before, either. And he said, "I'm never going to put you down." He rocked me to sleep that night, singing that Mockingbird song, you know, "Hush, little baby, don't say a word." I sang it to Faith today, and I could remember all the words, or at least the ones my father knew. He sang to me, and when I woke up in the morning, he was sleeping on the floor next to my bed.
"Whoa," said Skip. He looked over at Faith and saw that she was up on her little arms doing what he thought of as baby push-ups, staring at all of them. "She's awake," he said, just to have something to say, to fill a silence that seemed to fill his heart.
"She gives you that same feeling, doesn't she?" Jennifer said. "That feeling of absolute security, that everything's going to be okay." Faith's head dropped, then came up again.
"She looks like a turtle," Skip said.
"Charles, that's a dreadful thing to say," Mrs. Blessing said. "She most certainly does not."
"She doesn't really make me feel secure at all," Skip said. "She makes me feel afraid that something will go wrong, that she'll fall out of the crib or get some really bad disease or stop breathing or something."
"You're a pessimist."
"I guess. I guess maybe I have to be."
"I don't see why," Jennifer said, clearing the plates. "She's yours. It's been 3 months. She's yours."
"She really needs her shots," Skip said. "I have the doctor coming next week," Mrs. Blessing said.
"Nothing bad will happen," Jennifer said. "She'll learn to walk and talk, and we'll make up some kind of story to get her into school, and she'll have this great place to live and these great people to live with. What could be bad, right, honey?"
Jennifer Foster turned with her hands full of dishes, and there was Faith lying on her back, holding her feet in her hands. As if in answer to their question, she arched her back and rolled back over onto her stomach.
"Faith Cuddy," Jennifer cried, "you rolled over! You rolled over both ways, front to back and back to front."
She put down the dishes and clapped her hands. "You rolled over!"
"Has she done that before, Charles?" Mrs. Blessing said. "Not that I know of," Skip said. "Maybe she's been doing it behind my back." And Jennifer laughed, and Mrs. Blessing laughed, too, a dry laugh, out of practice. But Skip just kept thinking of Jennifer saying, "Faith Cuddy." It was the first time he'd ever thought of that name. Printed crooked on the top of lined paper. Typed in at the top of a report card. Underneath a yearbook picture. Faith Cuddy. Maybe Jennifer understood better than he did. Maybe things would be all right.
"There she goes again," said Jennifer.
Nadine was more irritable on rainy days than she was the rest of the time. "I think it reminds her of home," said Jennifer, who was sitting at the kitchen table sipping tea from the heavy mugs kept for the help, waiting around with the monitor turned down low in her pocket for Faith to wake up from her nap so she could give her a bottle. "I did a report in 7th grade that said Korea has 3 months of the year, I think, when all it does is rain. My dad asked her once if she wanted to go back to visit. She said he was crazy." Jennifer had a good, strong voice, which was useful since Nadine had the old dryer going and the vacuum running along with the sump pump banging away. Even though the walls seemed to be vibrating, Mrs. Blessing could hear Nadine slamming doors and heaving the old Hoover violently around in the upstairs rooms. It had been raining for 4 straight days since the evening they'd picnicked on the porch. "I can't imagine she would care to go back," Mrs. Blessing said. "It would probably be entirely different than she remembers it." The last time Mrs. Blessing had gone to New York for the funeral of Benny's mother, she had not known the place. A man in rags had lurched at the car the Cartons had sent for her and pushed a paper cup full of change toward the window, and the house where she had lived as a small girl had been pulled down for a building that looked like an aluminum jack-in-the-box. Bertram's itself had added an enormous gymnasium, like a horrible brick growth upon the old facade. And just inside the park, 3 girls in the gray skirt and blue blazer with the familiar crest were smoking cigarettes. "At least it's tobacco they're smoking," Meredith had said wearily as she complained. Outside, the wind blew suddenly, and the screens rattled in their frames. The spillway to the pond had become choked with leaves and branches, and Skip was out in an old pair of waders of her father's and a barber that Sunny had bought years ago in London, clearing out the tangle. From the kitchen window, she could just make out the red John Deere cap he was wearing and the flash of a yellow bucket. He'd been working out there most of the morning, sloshing from the lawn to the pond. "Charles," she cried from the kitchen door, a ghost behind the thick screen as he trotted toward the garage. "Come in here." "That baby is really sleeping," Jennifer said. "She's in for her long nap," Mrs. Blessing said, as if it were the most natural thing in the world for the two of them to be keeping track of a baby's schedule. "I hope he has her well wrapped up. It's very chilly and damp." "You know he does." The workmen who were hired to put things right from time to time grumbled that, grand as it was, Blessings had been poorly sighted. Or perhaps it was that it was placed in as good a spot as any when it had been a small farmhouse, two rooms up, two down, outhouse over the knoll 150 years ago. But by the time Edwin Blessing had added on the library wing and the long porch, the guest suites and the new dining room with the stone fireplace made from the stones dug to make the foundation, the big garage on the high side and the pond on the lower lawn, the house was smack in the center of a downward flow of water in a heavy rain. It was the rainiest September in decades, pearl-gray sheets of water veiling the house and the hills, and the basement flooded. One of Jess's boys had persuaded Mrs. Blessing 30 years before to put in a sump pump, and as soon as the water crept to the level of the platform for the washer and dryer, the pump clicked on and began to work with a sound like someone jackhammering the concrete just below the kitchen floor. Mrs. Blessing had always found the racket soothing, as though she knew she was getting her money's worth. One of the reasons she'd been so disconcerted the night of the lightning strike was that the pump hadn't come on with all the electrical lines down. She remembered some years ago when she had given a small open house at Christmas time, and it had been unseasonably warm. Instead of drifts of snow, there had been huge washes of water across the drive, and the pump had come on, and the guests had shouted at one another across their cut crystal cups of eggnog. Nadine shut off the vacuum upstairs and came down, her glossy black hair still damp on her forehead and the nape of her neck. "You still here?" she said to Jennifer, who had stopped at the post office and picked up a box, two nightgowns from Pettiflure on 79th Street. "I'm leaving soon, Mommy." "You are here too much. You go to class now. Work." "I only have afternoon classes 2 days a week this term, and I'm working nights for a month. I'll go soon." "Nonsense. You have lunch with me," Mrs. Blessing said. "Tuna on toast."
"Ay, ay, ay," cried Nadine.